This podcast details true crime cases. It contains adult themes and may contain descriptions of violence. It is not intended for children. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for today's episode of Once Upon a Crime. In this month's series, we'll take a look at people who were manipulated into committing murder. First up, we'll look at a case where a mother pressures her child to kill his father. That fact alone would make this story truly horrible. But it was not the last murder Marie Witte orchestrated. The next one would be as cold-hearted as it was gruesome. This is Chapter 1 in the series Manipulated to Murder, The Crimes of Hilma Marie Witte. This is Esther, host of Once Upon a Crime. Can you believe we are just a few short weeks away from CrimeCon 2024? Well, I can't wait to meet you all in Nashville from May 31st to June 2nd for the world's best true crime event. CrimeCon is an immersive weekend-long experience that takes you front row to hear about the latest investigations and teachings about cutting-edge scientific techniques. You'll also get sneak peeks into the hottest binge-worthy true crime shows and documentaries, and rub elbows with celebrities in the true crime world. If you're a follower of true crime, you will not want to miss it. Mark your calendars for May 31st to June 2nd and secure your tickets today. Bring along your best partners in true crime and make sure to come and meet me on Podcast Row in Nashville at CrimeCon 2024. Grab your discount using my promo code ONCE. It really helps out the show and gives you a 10% savings off your standard badge for CrimeCon. A win-win. I can't wait to see you. Go to crimecon.com for tickets and information or to our website, truecrimepodcast.com, and click on upcoming events, and I'll see you there. In 1984, 18-year-old Eric Witte received a phone call while stationed at a naval base in San Diego, California. He joined the Navy after graduating from high school in Indiana and had just begun his boot camp training when he got a frantic phone call from his mother, Marie. "You have to come home," she told him. "There's been an accident, and Grandma Elaine is dead." Eric drew in a shaky breath. While this news was shocking, he'd later admit to himself that it wasn't a complete surprise. He requested leave from the Navy due to a family emergency and drove 2,000 miles home to Michigan City, Indiana. When he arrived, his mother Marie and brother John, whom everyone called Butch, were waiting for him. Marie took Eric to a large freezer chest that was locked up with chains and a padlock. She unlocked the freezer and opened it. Eric's blood ran cold when he saw what was inside. There were several black plastic garbage bags stuffed into the freezer. Although the contents were frozen, the unmistakable smell of death still wafted out. Dried blood had oozed out of the bags and was smeared inside the walls. Holding his hand over his mouth and nose in horror and disgust, Eric turned his attention to his mother. She was angry. "This is your fault," she told him. "You need to take care of this. You have to get us out of this mess." The sad fact was that Eric Witte had been taking care of his mother's messes since he was a child. When he was just 9 years old, his mother began pressuring him to commit murder. "Wouldn't it be better if your father was dead?" she told the third grader. "Then we could live happily ever after." Hilma Marie Crist, born in 1948, was raised in Delray Beach, Florida. Her father had an unusual occupation. He managed a nudist camp in the Sunshine State. The family lived at the resort, and according to Marie's half-sister Regina, she, her parents, and siblings, quote, "walked around nude all the time, but as a child, I never felt uncomfortable. Dark-haired Marie was petite and pretty. According to her siblings, she was also sneaky and manipulative. When a piece of equipment at the resort pool was found damaged, Marie began a whisper campaign, starting a rumor that one of the other children was responsible. Whether Marie had caused the damage and wanted to point the attention away from herself, or she just enjoyed seeing someone else punished, is unknown. But she was successful in her attempts to manipulate the situation, and the other child was blamed. While she was still a teen, she met a man 10 years her senior who'd come to the resort for a vacation. Paul Witte was 25 and Marie 15 when they met and became attracted to one another. Paul was born in Michigan City, Indiana, and had recently been discharged from the Navy. He'd come to Florida on vacation. Paul Witte became intrigued upon hearing about the clothing optional resort and decided to give it a go. Meeting the pretty teenage Marie was just an added bonus during his vacation. Paul returned to Indiana, where he had taken a job in a steel mill. He also served as a volunteer firefighter for his community of Beverly Shores. He told his family about his vacation and about Marie. He kept thinking about her, and before long, he made a second trip to Florida. When he came home, he brought Marie, his new bride, with him. She was 16, and Paul was 27 when they tied the knot in 1964. 2 years later, their first child, Eric, was born. Their second son, John, who was nicknamed Butch, was born 3 years after his brother in 1969. Paul Witte's family was not taken with his teen bride. She kept a messy house, and according to his sister Barbara, quote, "She was not what I imagined my brother would marry. She was loud, and nobody, at least in my family, was impressed with her." Paul and Marie Witte and their two boys settled in Beverly Shores, a community of less than 1,000 people, located on the south shore of Lake Michigan. Paul provided for his family of five as a steel worker, and Marie stayed home to raise their sons. Firstborn Eric had a close relationship with his father and often joined him in his favorite activities, camping, hunting, and fishing. His brother Butch was more of a mama's boy, according to family members. Marie kept him close, while Eric spent most of his time with his father. Paul Witte was a strict disciplinarian, and Eric felt great pressure to live up to his father's expectations. He was expected to act like a man, show his father respect at all times, get good grades, do his chores without complaint, and take care of his mother and brother while Paul was at work. Eric tried very hard to be obedient and make his father proud, but like any child, he wasn't always perfect. But Paul didn't allow mistakes. He had a bad temper and often lashed out in anger when Eric fell short. Paul was quick with the belt and sometimes his fists. Eric remembers being backhanded in the face when he was only 8 years old. Paul would beat his son with a belt until his arms grew tired and he was out of breath. Marie didn't step in to help her son when the beatings began, but Eric says he didn't blame her. Quote, "It would have been no use. She'd have gotten hit too," he explains. But afterward, his mother was always there to comfort him and see to his cuts and bruises, and occasionally take him to the hospital for his injuries. It was after one particularly brutal beating, while Marie was comforting her son, that she told him, "This has to stop. Don't you think it would be better if your father was dead?" She began discussing their need to get rid of Paul. She often expressed how much better their life would be if his father was gone. She began encouraging her son to, quote, "think of the best way to do so," making the 9-year-old responsible for coming up with a plan. With Marie providing hints, together Eric and his mother decided to make Paul sick enough to cause his demise. Marie began spiking his food and drinks with rat poison and other substances. It made him ill, but not enough to cause his death. Eric often witnessed his mother spiking his father's meals. It became so common that the boys kept track of which dishes at the dinner table they should avoid. Marie continued this practice for years. Oddly, she never tried to leave or divorce her husband. To Marie, the better option was for her husband to, quote, "die naturally." Then she'd keep his pension and the house. She explained to Eric if she divorced his father, they would end up penniless and have nowhere to go. But it appeared that Marie Whitty was simply biding her time. She wanted her husband dead, but she wasn't willing to do the deed herself. Finally, when Eric turned 15, Marie told him it was time for him to step up and solve the problem once and for all. In 1981, 33-year-old Marie Whitty wanted out of her marriage. She and her boys had suffered abuse at the hand of her husband for years. She never considered leaving or divorcing Paul Whitty. She told her sons that the settlement she'd received from a divorce wouldn't put a roof over their heads. Repeatedly, she told them that their only option was for her 43-year-old husband to die. She'd been grooming her son Eric to take the lead in getting rid of his father since he was 9 years old. Now that he was 15, she didn't mince words. "When are you going to get the nerve to shoot him?" she asked. Then she came up with a plan. Eric was told to hide behind the door, and when his father came home from work, he could catch him unaware and shoot him. They'd find some way to say it was an accident, Marie said. Even if he was charged with shooting his father, she said the worst that would happen would be that Eric would serve a couple of years in a juvenile facility and be released on his 18th birthday. Eric wasn't keen on the plan. While he feared his dad and was often the target of his abuse, in some ways, Eric said, his father was his best friend. He thought of the good times he'd spent with him, camping and fishing. He didn't think he had the nerve to murder him, but neither did he have the nerve to say no to his mother. Marie harangued him constantly about killing his father. She pleaded with him, saying it was their only way out. She made him feel responsible for her happiness and that of his little brother Butch. When Eric continued to procrastinate, Marie grew angry. She threatened him, saying if he didn't do it soon, she was going to leave. The boys would be left behind, and they would have to fend for themselves with their father, she told them. What Eric didn't know was that financial problems were adding to his mother's haste in ending Paul's life. They'd taken out a loan ostensibly to purchase new furniture for the home. Marie told Paul she'd ordered the furniture, but in reality, she'd spent the money. Paul had grown impatient and had demanded to know when the furniture would be delivered. Paul Whitty's sister would later report that, in August, her brother said he was planning to file for a divorce from Marie. In the last days of summer, Marie put added pressure on Eric. He tried to do what his mother said and hid behind the door to shoot his father, but he froze and could not pull the trigger. Finally, on September 1st, his mother gave him an ultimatum. She was going to leave the house for an hour or so, she said, and warned Eric that if she returned and his father wasn't dead, she would pack up and leave. Marie left her boys home alone. Paul came home from work a short time later. He went into the living room and laid down on the couch for a nap, as was his normal routine. Eric went upstairs and grabbed one of his father's guns, a .357 Magnum revolver. The last time he attempted to shoot his father, the gun had seemed so small. Eric described his father as big and powerful. He worried if he shot his father and Paul didn't die immediately, he wouldn't have the nerve to finish the job. Now with the powerful weapon in his hands, Eric slowly made his way downstairs. He stood a few feet away from his sleeping father and pointed the gun at the back of his head. Again, he froze. He didn't know how he could go through with it. He was terrified. Just then, he saw car headlights swing into the driveway and shine through the front window. His mother was home. He knew it was now or never. If she walked in and saw he'd chickened out again, he would be left behind, devoid of his mother's love and care, and he would be trapped with his dad. So would his little brother, and Eric didn't want to be responsible for ruining his life too. But most of all, he didn't want to disappoint his mother. As he stood above his father, he could hear his soft snoring. Eric could feel his heart hammering in his chest and the cold steel of the gun in his hands. As he heard the car come to a stop in the driveway, he sprang into action, pulling the trigger once. The bullet entered the top of Paul Whitty's head, killing him instantly. Just then, Marie entered the house. She looked at the shattered skull of her husband, his blood pooling on the couch cushions. Without emotion, she told Eric to hand her the gun. She called 911. Marie Witte appeared distraught and panicked when officers arrived. Eric was frozen in shock and rendered speechless. Marie told the officers her son had brought the gun downstairs to ask his father about it. They owned several firearms, but this was a new one. As he walked into the living room, Marie said that Eric had tripped on the rug. The gun had gone off accidentally, she told officers between sobs. Almost a week later, Eric was brought in for questioning by Indiana State Police Detective Sergeant Arlen Boyd. He told the detective the same story. Boyd wasn't entirely convinced the shooting was an accident, but believed it wasn't out of the realm of possibility. Quote, "It wasn't a well-kept house by any stretch of the imagination," Boyd later reported. "It wasn't impossible for what she said to have happened, someone tripping. So you keep an open mind," end quote. The detective interviewed two other people who were in the home at the time, Marie's youngest son, Butch, and her mother, Margaret Marcy O'Donnell. They both said they hadn't witnessed the shooting, so they weren't much help. With nothing else to go on, Paul Witte's death was deemed accidental. Marie Witte's bad housekeeping had served to bolster her story. Paul Witte's death didn't result in a large insurance payout. Marie only received $25,000 from the policy. However, she was entitled to her husband's pension and monthly survivor's benefits payments from Social Security. Karma may have played a role when Marie was forced to leave the family home the following year. The National Park Service took possession of the land the house sat on through the process of eminent domain. Paul's stepmother, Elaine Witte, had been widowed for over a dozen years. She lived alone in Michigan City and was more than happy to take in Marie, her widowed stepdaughter-in-law, and Marie's two boys who called her Grandma Elaine. For the next 3 years, the arrangement seemed to work out nicely. Marie and Elaine got along well, often sharing a cocktail in the evening and talking for hours. The boys settled into their new home with their grandmother, who was a kind and nurturing presence in their lives. Eric was in his last year of high school when he discovered something that made his blood run cold. He walked into the kitchen one evening to find his mother mixing something into his grandmother's drink. He startled her when he exclaimed, "What are you doing?" At first, Marie tried to laugh it off, but Eric demanded to know what was going on. Finally, her voice cold, she answered, "Your father's not the only person who needs to be punished." Eric couldn't fathom why his mother would harm his grandmother. His father had been a physical threat to them, but Elaine Witte had never been anything but kind and loving. He didn't understand his mother, but he knew one thing. He had to get out of there before she pressured him into helping her hurt someone again. Eric found his escape by joining the Navy. He thought that with him gone, his mother wouldn't have the nerve to do anything drastic to his grandmother. Just a few weeks later, Marie's phone call would dash any hopes Eric had of steering clear of his mother's murderous plans. Eric looked at the black plastic garbage bags in the freezer in horror. It was apparent what his mother was showing him was the dismembered remains of 74-year-old Elaine Witte. He also felt guilty. His mother said it was his fault they were in this mess. Because he had left, she said, his 14-year-old brother had been forced to kill Grandma. John Butch Witte was his mother's favorite. They were very close, and Marie had always poured the majority of her love and affection into her more quiet and sensitive son. She'd confided in him that she'd begun siphoning money from her mother-in-law's bank account by forging her signature on checks. She suspected that Elaine was onto the deception. Marie told Butch, if something wasn't done, they'd be thrown out into the street. Like she had with Eric, she badgered her youngest son, saying he needed to be a man and solve the problem. She had Butch help her attempt to kill the old woman through other means first. She made Elaine's cocktails extra strong and when she passed out in her bedroom, they opened up her window to the cold night air, hoping she'd catch a chill and die. When that didn't work, Marie tried the poisoning method as she had with Paul. Once again, this tactic failed her. She now gave Butch an ultimatum. He could either strangle his grandmother to death or shoot her with a crossbow. Butch, feeling he had no choice, but unwilling to resort to such a face-to-face confrontation as strangulation, chose the crossbow. In late 1983, Marie pressured her son. It has to happen now. On the morning of January 8, 1984, Marie woke the 14-year-old and handed him the crossbow. He complied with his mother's demand, shooting his grandmother in the rib cage. Within hours, Marie was on a train to Chicago to appear in court regarding the payment of benefits resulting from her husband's death. When she returned that evening, she set about getting rid of her mother-in-law's body. This time, she explained to Butch, they couldn't report the death. After what had happened to Paul, it would be too suspicious. No, they had to make it look like the old lady had just left town. That would also serve another purpose. If Elaine was still thought to be alive, her social security checks would continue to be mailed to the house. For months after Elaine's murder, Marie deposited Elaine's benefit checks and withdrew cash from her bank account. But Butch's nightmare was not yet over. Marie enlisted her son's help in dismembering his grandmother and disposing of the body parts. Over the next few weeks, using a chainsaw, knives, a trash compactor, a garbage disposal, a deep fat fryer, and a microwave oven, they reduced the remains to only the largest portions. They scattered some of them in different locations across Indiana and Illinois. What was left was put into bags in the freezer, the skull and femur, among other bones that could not be rendered small enough. Eric didn't want anything to do with this second murder, so he put his mother off by saying that he needed to return to the naval base. He promised to help her figure out what to do, and he would contact her soon. But Marie was growing frantic. Elaine's neighbors kept asking where she was. Marie told them she'd gone on an extended vacation. She was traveling across the country and was planning on making several stops before visiting her grandson in California, Marie claimed. But suspicions grew as the months passed. In May, Elaine's neighbor, who often saw the elderly woman outside tending to her yard, realized he hadn't seen her in weeks. He was no longer convinced by the vacation story and called the police, asking them to do a welfare check. When police arrived and questioned Marie, she stuck to her story. They noted that Elaine's car was still parked at the house, but Marie explained her mother-in-law was traveling by bus. Elaine's family would no longer be put off either. After weeks of not hearing from her, and after family birthdays passed with no one receiving Elaine's customary thoughtful birthday cards, Marie's story about an unannounced vacation didn't jibe. They called the police to report Elaine Whitty missing. Marie was feeling desperate and wasn't willing to wait for her son to come up with a plan. Eric started his return trip to California. After driving several miles, he began noticing an odor coming from the back of his car. He pulled off the road and opened the hatchback. There, under a tarp, he found a cooler filled with black garbage bags. Without warning him, his mother had placed the remains of his murdered grandmother in his car. Not knowing what to do, Eric kept driving, thinking he may be able to dump the cooler as he got closer to the West Coast. Halfway home, he saw the lights of a patrol car flashing behind him. A state trooper pulled Eric over for speeding and now approached, asking for his license and registration. Peering into the back of the car, the trooper spied the cooler. Perhaps thinking it contained alcohol, he asked Eric what was inside. Eric stammered something out, and suspicious now, the trooper said he would take a look. With growing panic, Eric reached for a revolver he had placed under his seat. He decided the trooper was either going to have to kill him or he'd have to kill the cop to get out of this jam. Suddenly, a speeder blew by them. The trooper abandoned his search of the car and took off after the driver. Eric breathed a sigh of relief and got out of the area as fast as he could go. Once he returned to San Diego, he disposed of the cooler and its remains in a large landfill. Hey guys, this is Esther, host of Once Upon a Crime. I've got an exciting opportunity that I'm so psyched to share with you. How would you like to travel the world with me? My second love after true crime is seeing the world. Now, I've been given the opportunity to host trips to destinations around the world and bring you, my listeners and friends of the show, along with me. But I need your help. I need your input to plan these trips. Where would you like to go? What kind of activities would you like to enjoy? Would you like to visit a city like New York, London, or Mexico City and check out the local entertainment, culture, and nightlife? Or would you prefer a tropical getaway like Bali or the Caribbean for laid-back sightseeing and beach days? Or anything in between? How about crossing off that trip to Turkey or Indonesia or Italy off your bucket list? Click on the link in the show notes to complete a short 2-minute survey and tell me what kind of travel you're most interested in. And I'll keep you informed about upcoming trips as soon as they're confirmed. We'll plan trips around your interests and budget, and we'll travel together as a small group. There's safety in numbers too, so single men and women are encouraged. Or bring your significant other or best friends along. Either way, it will be a blast. Click on the survey link right away. The sooner we get your responses, the sooner we'll be on the road together to new adventures. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to travel with you. Elaine Whitty's family filed a missing persons report in May 1984. The Michigan City Police Force was a small operation, so they contacted the Indiana State Police to aid in the missing persons investigation. As luck would have it, Detective Sergeant Arlen Boyd, the same officer who investigated Paul Whitty's shooting, was assigned the case. He recognized Marie Whitty's name, and on August 14, 1984, showed up on her doorstep. When she opened the door, the detective said, she just about fainted. The missing person report on Elaine Whitty had been filed 3 months earlier. She had not been seen for nearly 8 months. Marie Whitty was visibly nervous while answering the detective's questions, but continued to repeat the vacation story. But Boyd's investigation turned up several red flags. There had been no long-distance phone calls made either to or from Elaine's home phone number. Wouldn't she have been calling to check in if she were traveling? It was also discovered that Marie had sold Elaine's car. If the woman was planning to return, why was her car sold? Finally, the investigation determined that large amounts of money had been withdrawn from Elaine's bank account locally, after Marie said she left on her trip. The bank withdrawals began in January 1984 and continued until May or June. Elaine's monthly Social Security checks were still being signed and cashed in town during the same time period. Because Social Security funds come from the federal treasury and were suspected of being stolen, federal authorities now joined the investigation. But by the time this evidence was discovered, Marie and her son Butch had left town. Investigators tracked down Marie's mother, Marcy O'Donnell, and brought her in for questioning on October 26th. After some time and added pressure from a Detective Boyd, Marcy admitted that her daughter had told her 14-year-old son Butch accidentally shot and killed his grandmother. When asked about the body, Marcy answered, "There is no body." Elaine Whitty's house was searched, but nothing of note was found. Elaine had been missing for nearly a year. Detectives were keeping tabs on Elaine Whitty's bank account, and in November, it paid off. One of her Social Security checks was cashed in Chula Vista, California, a town located on the Mexican border. Marie Whitty had arrived in San Diego and insisted that Eric leave with her and Butch and go into hiding. She said the police would be coming to arrest him and his brother. She would take them across the border until things cooled down. Eric complied, only stopping long enough to grab a duffel bag with some clothes. Officers apprehended Marie, Eric, and Butch on November 7, 1984, before they could cross the border. They were initially charged with forgery. Mother and sons were split up and interviewed separately. Marie claimed to have no knowledge of what happened to Elaine, but 14-year-old Butch almost immediately confessed. When asked why he'd murdered his grandmother with a crossbow, he answered, "I wanted to help my mom out." He said he'd gathered courage the night before by drinking alcohol and smoking weed in the basement. Marie had drugged Elaine with Valium, and he'd shot her while she slept. After his grandmother was dead, Butch said he'd cried and was upset, but his mother told him not to worry about it. Why had they dismembered the body, investigators asked. Butch said, so he wouldn't have to go through the same thing my brother did, a police investigation. He then told investigators the details of his father's murder 3 years earlier. After learning that his brother had confessed, Eric agreed to cooperate with investigators and testify against his mother. The death of Paul Witte was reopened as a homicide investigation. Eric provided details about the attempted poisoning of his father before his mother planned his murder and coerced him into committing the crime. Eric took responsibility for shooting his father, but said he would have never done it if he hadn't felt pressured by his mother. All three were returned to Indiana to face charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Marie's 59-year-old mother, Marcy O'Donnell, was also charged with assisting a criminal. A Navy buddy of Eric's was also charged with helping to dispose of Elaine Witte's remains. John Butch Witte admitted in court to killing his grandmother with a crossbow. The state agreed to accept his guilty plea on the condition that he testify at his mother's trial. His sentence was reduced to a charge of voluntary manslaughter. He received a 20-year prison sentence. After his sentencing, he met with investigators to tell them what he knew about his dad's murder. He said his brother had been manipulated into killing him by their mother. Eric was interviewed and corroborated the account. Prosecutors told the jury that Hilma Marie Witte was a cold and calculating woman who wanted her mother-in-law dead for financial gain. Quote, we're talking about a cold, calculating, vicious conjuring of a plan and waiting until this senior citizen was at her weakest moment, lying in her bed, William Herbach said. Marie Witte used her children to carry out her plan to escape responsibility for the crimes. She manipulated them by playing on their emotions and finally threatening to abandon them if they did not do as she commanded. She'd had no compunction for what she was putting them through, forcing them to violently end the lives of people whom they loved and live with that guilt forever. While it's true that Paul Witte was an abusive and violent man, and Marie's initial motivation for killing him was to end this situation, she had other methods at her disposal. She could have left him, taking her sons out of harm's way and escaping to her home state of Florida. She could have reported his child abuse to the authorities, or she could have simply granted him the divorce, which Paul told his sister he was pursuing. Every account of Marie's plans towards murder involved financial motivations. She said she couldn't leave her husband because she wouldn't receive enough in the divorce settlement. She lied about a loan they'd received to purchase furniture, and instead, without her husband's knowledge, used the money for her own purposes. Finally, she admitted that she'd been stealing money from her mother-in-law and was concerned that Elaine would discover the theft and put an end to it. As Eric put it, his father may have been a physical threat, but his grandmother never was. She had been nothing but kind and loving towards Marie, Butch, and Eric. She was simply an inconvenience to Marie, who decided she must die. In 1985, Hilma Marie Witte was found guilty of murder and conspiracy to commit murder in the case of Elaine Witte. She received a 90-year prison sentence. Both of her sons pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter and testified at her trial in the murder of Paul Witte. Eric Witte received a 20-year prison sentence for his part in his father's killing, and 5 additional years for assisting a criminal in his grandmother's case. Marie was found guilty of murder and conspiracy to commit murder in Paul Witte's case. She received an additional 50 years to run concurrently with her 90-year sentence. Her mother, Marcy O'Donnell, was sentenced to 6 years for assisting a criminal. It was determined that she knew of the plot to kill Elaine Witte and helped dispose of the body. In 1996, John and Eric Witte were released from prison after serving 11 years. Their sentences were reduced due to good behavior. 12 years later, John Butch Witte died at the age of 39. Eric Witte took full responsibility and expressed remorse for the murder he committed at age 16. He told his story in a moving episode of the true crime television series, Evil Lives Here, in 2016. During his interview, he said, quote, I have to live every day knowing that I took out one of the most important figures in my life. What I can do is live my life and make it a good one, because it cost me a hell of a lot to get it. In 2022, Eric Whitty died at the age of 56. Marcy O'Donnell has also since passed. Only Marie Whitty survives. In 2002, she petitioned the Court of Appeals to have her sentence reduced. Her modification petition stated, quote, "She has, through therapy, counseling, groups, education, time, and self-introspection, overcome the issues in her life which brought her to prison," end quote. Her prison record also details her activities behind bars, including participating in groups for domestic violence, anger management, incest survivors, and assertiveness training. She also earned a Bachelor of Arts degree. The prosecutor for LaPorte County, William Herbach, opposed any reduction in her sentence, saying that she took the lives of two people and ruined the lives of her sons through her manipulations. He stated that throughout her trial, he never once saw her show any remorse or emotion for the murders. Quote, "She's the coldest lady I could ever recall during a trial," he said. Her petition was denied. She continues to serve her sentence at Indiana Women's Prison. She is now 76 years old. Her earliest possible release date will be in 2027. That will do it for this episode of Once Upon a Crime. Join me again next week for another episode of the series, Manipulated to Murder. If you listen to my announcement during this episode, you learn that I'll be hosting trips, and you, my listeners, are invited to travel with me. You can help me out by completing an 8-question survey so I can start planning our first adventure. Thanks. Also, check the show notes for information about CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime convention. I'll be in Nashville on CrimeCon's Podcast Row, May 31st to June 2nd, and I can't wait to meet you and talk true crime. Don't forget to use my offer code ONCE to score your discount. Get all the information by clicking on the link in the show notes or at our website, truecrimepodcast.com. Once Upon a Crime is written and produced by me, Esther Sanchez Ludlow. My executive producer is Lorena Garcia, and research for this episode was provided by Emma Battaglia. Until next time, be good to one another.